From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Day two, Marjorie.
Day two.
We're still here. Tell the truth for a second. Wasn't there a small part of you that was worried the locks would be changed?
We're back. We're here. We're thrilled you're tuning in. We're thrilled we're here for day two. I hope it's day three and four and five.
I'm counting on it. One thing we forgot yesterday, Joyce Cole Haywick was kind enough to join us to celebrate my movie of the year. Of course, that'd be Ted. And we forgot to mention her terrific website. It's joyceschoices.com. Now, with us first today is a Dorchester kid. He worked his way up to be chief national correspondent at CNN. He's America's biggest Red Sox fan. He'll be with us every Tuesday at noon. Good afternoon, John King.
Hi, John.
Jim and Marjorie, talk about the luck of the Irish. You get a brief vacation, and then you get to sleep in, but then continue the gig.
That's right. Only two of the three of us are Irish, but we won't hold that.
Great to have you back, John.
We won't hold that against Jim. Thanks for being with us, John. So I'm dying to know what you think about this, John. We've been hearing from Obama, you know, lists of every devastating cut. We're all going to be crushed with the sequester looming. You know, travel delays, laid off firefighters, preschoolers thrown out of the street from their Head Start programs. Is this all real, or is there a boy crying wolf here thing going on?
It's some of both, actually, in the sense that, look, the things that would be politically most sensitive, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, military pay, veterans benefits, those are all protected because that's not discretionary spending. So that's exempt from the so-called sequester, which is a fancy word for children at play, in my view. There will be painful cuts, no question about that. The Republicans rightly argue the federal budget, even if all $85 billion of these over the next 7 months are implemented, the federal government will still spend more this year than it did last year. That's a fact. What the Republicans are banking on is that it won't be as devastating in the first day, first week, and they actually think by the end of 2 weeks, if something doesn't happen faster, and there's nothing on the horizon right now, that within a week or two, then they cut some kind of a deal, or they send the president, again, it's another crazy word because we don't have a budget in Washington. Your government does not work, folks. A continuing resolution that gives the administration the flexibility to actually give agencies the power to move money around and not have those cuts devastating. So on paper, it's real. The rhetoric right now on both sides is still rather hyperbolic.
Yeah, but John, do these guys down there, guys and women, realize it's almost as if they're sitting in a room and saying, you know, there's still three people in Iowa who do not think we are totally clueless, and we're bound to convince them that we can't fix anything. Are they worried about losing even greater confidence from the American public, not to mention the financial markets?
Well, I keep saying it can't get worse, and I keep being proven wrong in the sense of the distrust and the dysfunction between these guys. But remember, a couple of important things here. Look, the president won the election, and the president thinks that, therefore, I should get my way at least a lot more often than the Republicans do. But remember, there are only 14 of all the House Republicans in the majority. There are only 14 that go home to districts carried by Barack Obama. The rest go home to districts carried by Mitt Romney. They don't think they need to listen to this president. And guess what? They just got reelected after a couple of years of not listening to this president. So when it comes to the House Republicans, who are the key piece here, they don't feel they have to listen to the president. And if you're looking for compromises on the Democratic side, only seven of those guys go home to districts carried by Mitt Romney. So where's the incentive to compromise? So you see Lindsey Graham and John McCain are going to the White House again today. It was originally to talk about immigration, and that will be one of the topics. But now they also say they'll talk about the sequestration. You know, Lindsey Graham says, well, this might be an opportunity to get the big grand bargain discussions back on the table, meaning the Republicans will give you more tax increases if the president gives them Social Security and Medicare cuts. However, Senate Republicans may talk that way, and not all of them, but some Senate Republicans may talk that way. But you still have in the House, John Boehner, the Speaker, gave the president tax increases just 6 weeks ago. The president's asking Republicans to go to their holy grail and raise taxes again just 6 weeks later. The Republicans aren't going to do that. They're just not going to do that.
You know, I want to go stay on taxes just for one final second here, John. Is a couple of times in his first term, Barack Obama drew a line in the sand and then walked over it, basically capitulating, blinking on this thing. He said he wouldn't on the fiscal cliff discussions, and he didn't. As you said, he got what he wanted. I don't hear the same sort of rhetoric here. I mean, he is saying things like, you know, the Republicans care more about their wealthy friends than they do about poor people and heating oil, whatever. But is Barack Obama going to hold firm on this tax thing, or is ultimately the deal where the cuts are to be felt?
Well, I think both sides are going to hold firm in the sense that the Republicans think this is their only way to get the cuts. They think in every one of these deals, the president gets more from them, including in the last one, a tax increase, and yet they don't get structural changes to Medicare and Social Security. They don't get the path of federal spending actually going down. Remember, even if these cuts are implemented, spending would still go up over from last year. And so both sides think there's something to be gained here. The president, if you look at the public opinion polling, he has the, not by a huge margin, but he has the upper hand. People think, you know, the Republicans are being more obstinate here. The public overall thinks the president's quote-unquote balanced approach for more revenues is the right approach. But here's the risk. He could win in the short term, but so hurt himself in his terms of his maneuverability in his second term. Because if this thing, these cuts, hurt the economy, that's what this president needs. That's the lifeblood of his second term. So he needs a stronger economy to give more optimism, not only in the country, but in Washington to get things done. And if the level of dysfunction goes even lower, which, again, I never thought was possible, how did he get gun control conversations? How did he get immigration? How did he get movement on some issue we're not even thinking about yet when the animosity between him and the conservatives is getting greater?
Well, let's get back to gun control and immigration in just a second. I have to get in a local question here. We're listening to John King from CNN. What do you call that, John? Is it the magic wall? Is that what you have during the elections where you move all the colors?
No, he calls it his best friend. That's what he calls it. What is that thing called?
It's Geppetto. I'm Pinocchio.
Okay, close enough. I'm dying to know what you think about this. Our new senator here, Senior Senator Elizabeth Warren, I thought she had a great debut a few days back when Obama's bank regulators came before her banking committee. Let's hear a bit of that sound from Elizabeth Warren.
There are district attorneys and U.S. attorneys who are out there every day squeezing ordinary citizens on sometimes very thin grounds and taking them to trial in order to make an example, as they put it. I'm really concerned that too big to fail has become too big for trial. That just seems wrong to me.
And she went on to say, how many big Wall Street banks, you guys, have you ever taken to trial? And of course, I don't think they've taken any, or if they have, I don't know about them. I thought this was fantastic.
It's smart on her part. Look, she's known as the consumer advocate, the populist. She's new in town. You just said an amazing sentence, right? Senior Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Massachusetts, right.
Under Kennedy. Kennedy and Kerry had all this experience, and now she's the senior senator. She's been here a couple of weeks. Wait till the next appropriations bill, Massachusetts. But look, it's smart of her to come here and plant the flag, to be a populist. We'll see how she does in some of the other issues that she has. You know, every senator, I don't mean to pick on her, every senator has a learning curve to sort of learn, you know, the foreign policy issues and deep into the minutiae of the budget. So she's planting this flag here. Now, the government's excuse, and I think most Americans agree with her. Why aren't the big banks called into court? The Justice Department says, look, they've got thousands of lawyers. They can spend millions of dollars on the defense, and we just get out lawyered, and we lose in the end, or it drags on for 5 years, so we have to cut plea bargains. That's what the government says. Do people buy that? No, I don't know. So I think she's smart to come in and try to plant the flag, a national identity, a populist, take on the big banks. And we'll watch her as she grows beyond that. But I think most people in Massachusetts, you know, at least she came here to do what she said she was going to do.
Well, not only that, but she seemed to me so in command, knew everything about her subject, and was smarter than a lot of the people she was addressing. I thought it was a stunning first moment.
Well, it's also a good position to be in when you know what the answer is. Nobody. We've taken nobody to trial. It puts you in a good spot. Hey, John King, a couple of seconds ago, you mentioned immigration and guns on the horizon. The conventional wisdom outside of Washington, I don't know what it is there, is there will be a pathway to citizenship on immigration. There will be something on gun control, even if it's not a ban on assault weapons. If they can't figure out something on this sequester, why should Americans be hopeful that anything's going to happen on these other two issues?
I wouldn't be overly optimistic on either one. I think the president will get more robust background checks in the end. A lot of Republicans are open to that. I don't think he's going to get new gun controls. I don't know if you consider more robust, I'm not sure he'll even get the universal background check he wants. But if you consider near universal background checks, gun control, then he'll get something.
Well, what does that mean in English? If not universal, there are 40% of the guns that are purchased, as you know, private gun sales on the internet, whatever, no background checks. What's the middle position? What does he get?
If you look at the state of Virginia, after Virginia Tech, they passed a law, and it's a big gun rights state. Eric Cantor said he's comfortable with that law. It's not 100%, but it's a lot higher than the 60%. Mm-hmm. And so something like that. There are still some things, if you pass it down to a family member, if you pass it down to a neighbor, tiny operations. There's some loopholes, you know, openings, if you will. What the gun rights community would call common sense, you know, steps that aren't covered by the background checks, but it does make a lot of progress. But right now, the math is not there for the assault weapons ban. Right now, the math is not there even for outlawing these larger clips with 20 or 30 rounds in them. So the president's going to have to, I think, take something significantly less than what he's asking for on that one, unless something dramatically changes. You said, is a path to citizenship a done deal? I'd be careful there. I'd be really careful there. I think you might be able to get a path to legal status through the Republican House. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, it's a new chairman. The old chairman, Lamar Smith, was, forgive my language, folks, hell no when it came to a path to citizenship. He called that outright amnesty, said never going to happen. The new chairman, Bob Goodlatte, in the past has used amnesty, but he's being very careful with his words now. But he's also been clear he's very, very skeptical about a path to citizenship. You might see the House pass legal status, but not a path to citizenship. And then the question is, will the Democrats and the president accept that compromise, or will they say no? It's citizenship or nothing, and will we go into 2014 and they run on the issue and they don't take the compromise?
We're talking to CNN's John King. I wonder, John, there's been a lot of blowback. I don't know if you watched the Oscars on Sunday night, but Michelle Obama, of course, presented the Best Movie Award at the end of the evening, which is pretty unusual. A lot of complaining down in D.C. Tell us about it.
A lot of conservatives say, what are they doing? Why are they using the White House, the public airwaves, being part of this program? It's sort of a free political ad for the White House. Come on. I was going to say, I love the dress. I'm not sure about the bangs. I thought that you were going to have to be a fashion critic here. She's in the second term. She was very cautious early in the first term. I had somebody next to me who doesn't like trash. That's not nice. I'm parked, by the way. She was very cautious in the first term, was very active in the campaign. It's a second-term president and first lady. There's a lot of talk that, she actually likes this kind of celebrity stuff and the Hollywood stuff. And maybe we'll see her doing more of it because she doesn't have to worry about another election.
Yeah.
She doesn't have to worry that some people will take offense. You know what? She's raising two kids in the White House. There's a lot of pressure. She just went through a campaign. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, an agnostic, an independent, or something in between, leave her alone. Take your issues out with the president. If she has a public policy issue, fine. Then it's in the public sphere. But let her have a little fun. What was the harm in that?
Hey, John.
Just making him look too cozy with the White House, I guess. Hollywood, the whole
thing.
Then
look at all the Hollywood money and write those stories if you want and raise all that up. But, let the first lady have some fun.
No, but Marjorie thought the compromise was John Boehner should have presented Best Director or something, or Best Foreign Film, John. Hey, John, before we get to your favorite topic,
Best tanning and makeup.
He doesn't look as orange.
No, he's not as orange.
If you notice, what's up with that, John? I think he's laid off a little bit of the tanning salon, or maybe he's changed his moisturizer. I don't know. But he doesn't look as orange anymore.
I've known this speaker a long time, and again, I don't take sides in my business, but the president probably has the toughest job in Washington because of everything he has to deal with. This speaker, if you go to a few House Republican meetings, he's got a tough job. So, again, I'm not endorsing or opposing any of his policies, but we need to give him a break every now and then.
One of the funniest lines, I'm sure, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was at Obama's first when he said, John Boehner and I, and I'm paraphrasing, have a lot in common. We're both people of color. Of course, his color does not appear naturally. Yeah. In any case, John, you're the biggest Red Sox fan I have ever known. Hope springs eternal in the King household. Do you feel that hope this year? Are you feeling the love, John King?
I actually found myself rooting for John Lackey the other day. And I thought, dear Lord, what has happened? Did they lobotomize me in my sleep? I'm always hopeful at this time of year. And why shouldn't we be? If you look on paper, we got a lot of challenges. But we also cleaned up a lot of the mess from last year. I'm a fan of John Farrell. I think a lower key management style, but a baseball guy. Let's be optimists. We're supposed to be underdogs, so it's actually nice to be an underdog again. Anyone who's older than 25 or 30 remembers that to be a Red Sox fan is to always be an underdog. So I actually like this position. It's a lot more, I guess my DNA is accustomed to it a little better. So, amen, let's go.
Hey, speaking of underdogs, last question, political question. You were mentioning underdogs. In about 2 minutes, we're going to be joined by Boston City Councilor John Connolly, who an hour and 20 minutes ago announced that he was running against Tom Eno. As a handicapper, and you're a Boston kid, what's the likelihood that Tom Eno could ever be beaten on the ballot, John King?
Well, you're going to make me disclose my secret deal that I've asked Mayor Menino to stay in office until I can move back to Boston and run for mayor. rules were made to be broken, so I don't want to get in the way and get in the middle of the Boston mayoral race. But look, Mayor Menino, I grew up in my politics covered. I grew up in Boston, but my first political job was in Providence, when everyone thought Buddy Fianti would be mayor for life. And I moved to Washington, and Marion Barry was mayor for life. Mayor Menino, I'm not getting in the middle of the race. A lot of people think he's mayor for life. He's hard to beat. He's hard to beat, especially, the question always is the city economy and how do people feel about the schools, and if you get another snowstorm, did the plows come through? Mm-hmm. Of course he's hard to beat. He's been there a long time, and there's institutional advantages, shall we say. We used to call it other things in the old days. But I think any time, again, I'm not picking sides here, any time you have competition in politics, one of the reasons the House of Representatives, the Congress is so screwed up, again, excuse my language, is that there's no competition in these races. So I think competition is healthy for the system. And if there's a good challenge to the mayor, he's going to have to fight back, isn't he?
John King, you go to the IOP at Harvard. What's that all about?
I'm doing a visiting fellowship. It's about 8 weeks long. The great students, God, they take your cynicism away. They're just great students from all over the country, in fact, all over the world. And it's a visiting fellowship. They were so nice to sort of carve out a new role for me. They have specific roles for other people, and I couldn't fit the schedule. So I'm there for like 8 weeks on Thursdays. If you're around, anyone can pop in for a study group in the afternoon. I'm bringing the magic wall in this week to come to the study group with me. I want to bring up the technology on the road. And I'm just talking about the demographic changes in America and how, the increasing the rise of minorities, of African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, and how it's changing our politics. And then we have a freewheeling conversation every Thursday afternoon. It's the greatest thing. It brings me home to Red Sox Nation, and these students just inspire you with their energy.
Hey, congratulations, John King, and thanks for being with us today and being with us every Tuesday at noontime. That's John King, CNN's chief national correspondent, who, as we said, was going to be at Harvard as a fellow at their Institute of Politics, coming up. This is one of the bravest men in Boston, Jim. We're going to find out who it is up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. It is 1 hour and 22 minutes into the mayoral campaign of a guy whose nickname is Don Quixote. His real name is John Connolly, city councilor. He's challenging, if he runs, Tom Menino. Good morning, City Councilor Connolly.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much. And your announcement went well this morning?
It was great.
In front of Brighton High School?
Yeah, it was terrific.
Okay.
I was telling people I was going to run for Pope, and they said I might have a better chance doing that. But I'm going to mount
it. Stole my line, but thank you, John. I appreciate it.
John Kai, I'm looking at the front page of the Herald this morning, and they're commenting on your candidacy. Big headlines, Mission Impossible. They've got a list of all the people that have been crushed by Tom Menino. Peggy Davis Mullen, she lost. Tom Menino got 76% of the vote. Maura Hennigan, Tom Menino got 67%. The closest anybody's come was former city councilor Michael Flaherty, got 57% of the vote. So what's your plan, City Councilor Connolly?
Well, I think every race is different, and every candidate is different. And I love Tom Menino. He's a great guy. I've learned from him. I've worked with him. And you can't question his commitment to the city. But this campaign is going to be about Boston's future. And I'm going to run on something that no politician has run on in Boston in my lifetime. And that's improving our Boston public schools and talking about it in a very serious way. I'm a former teacher. I'm a Boston public school parent. And our schools, while we have islands of excellence out there, they come up short across the board. And it really goes to a top-heavy, bloated central bureaucracy spending $1 billion a year.
I remember talking to you about the last contract that was settled between the city and the teachers, and you said that even though the city was claiming this was a great breakthrough and Tom Menino was very happy, the city gave away too much to the teachers union in Boston. What'd they do wrong?
Yeah, that was a smoke and mirror show to call that a reform contract, and it was really the most cynical moment I've seen in my time in City Hall. We have one of the shortest school days in the United States, and they didn't come back with a contract that added a single minute to the school day. I would have given the teachers more money if that's what it took, but to come back without a single minute wasn't okay. The mayor could have directed the superintendent to implement the last best offer, and we would have gotten the longer school day. We also needed changes.
What is the school day now?
So it's about functionally, it's a little over 6 hours, but when we're on learning time, mm-hmm. we're really less than 6 hours. And that pales in comparison to just about every urban district you'll find out there.
So we're talking 2:30 in the afternoon.
Sometimes even before, depending on when you start your day. And, you know, this isn't about one of these arguments about moving to a 9-hour day.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about trying to get to a 7-hour day.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to speak, I just realized to the only candidate for mayor as of the moment, because Don Menino hasn't declared. I know schools are your deal, but you're the chair of the Education Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Every quote I've read from you, John Connolly, in last week, every quote includes what you just said. I love Tom Menino. So if you love Tom Menino,
I don't know if Tom Menino loves you too much
anymore. If you love Tom Menino, if Tom Menino, you believe, I'm sure, loves the city of Boston, and you were the education chair, why can't you work with the mayor to do some of the things that you think he's not doing for kids in Boston public schools rather than running against them, assuming he runs?
Well, I don't feel like we're getting the job done on the schools. And when I look at it from my perspective there, I've worked to get healthier food for our kids. I worked to transform that teacher's contract. And I've come up short on a lot of those battles. And I don't feel like the changes are going to happen if we don't get new leadership.
Well, speaking of change, we just read this morning, you're a big neighborhood school guy. This recommendation is going to go to the school committee.
I'm a big quality school guy.
Well,
I think part of that is having neighborhood schools.
Understood. And there's this neighborhood school plan that I think is going to be voted on, what is it, Wednesday or something, coming out of this committee or whatever day it is.
Yep.
Neighborhood schools, limited choice. Doesn't that take some of the wind out of the sails of your education reform agenda, John?
Well, I certainly think the way that it's being treated, it may. But when we look at the reality of these plans, they have deep flaws in them. And when they implement this plan that's going to the school committee, it's going to pass because it's a rubber stamp going from a Merrill-appointed task force to the Merrill-appointed school committee.
The mayor you love, is that the one we're talking about?
Listen, okay. I think he's a great guy, but our schools are coming up short, and we can do better. When it goes there, it's going to pass. And 2 years from now, we'll be sitting here, and parents will be on wait lists at schools saying, what was this all about? Why am I still number 23 on the wait list at the Gardner School in Brighton?
We're talking to City Councilor John Connolly, who just announced this morning that he is going to run against the longest sitting mayor in the history of the city of Boston.
If he runs.
Tom Menino. If he does run, he's not said whether or not he's going to run. But you know, this is a big issue for lots of us, including myself, moved out of Boston to get away from the Boston schools because I couldn't take the drama in August. Where's my kid going to go to school? And I think a lot of people, and it's got nothing to do with race issues anymore, they just don't like the idea of a five-year-old going 45 minutes from, you know, Brighton to Hyde Park or a bus kind of thing. So you lose a lot of that middle class in Boston. What do you do? What can you do now concretely if you were the mayor that would make it more attractive for people to actually stay in the city?
So the first thing I do around the schools would be to take a fine-tooth comb to that $1 billion budget and get more money to the classroom, lengthen the school day, and get a real student assignment policy that would allow communities to strengthen around schools. Beyond that, though, look, there's other issues, and we're going to talk about all the issues in this campaign. We've got to retain all that young talent that we're hemorrhaging. You know, Facebook and Microsoft were born in Boston, but they didn't grow up here.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to make sure that they grow up here. I when we see all those young folks who feed that creative economy and they come to you and they say, I can't afford a loft. I can't afford a place. So I have to leave this city I came to school to and fell in love with. You know, that's a big issue for us. And I think we can do a lot more in being creative and being bold and putting new ideas out there to really feed the life of the city. And the middle class becomes the cornerstone of it.
What about charter schools? We just saw the Renaissance Charter School, which is doing horribly.
Yep.
Many people thought that charter schools were the answer. That's not voting well for charter schools in the city.
Well, we have some of the best charter schools in the country here in Boston. The Renaissance obviously has its issues, but when you look at Roxbury Prep or you look at Match, you see a couple of the best in the country. I support our charter schools, and here's why. And I'm a Boston Public School parent. One, our charters offer a great education, typically to poor children of color who can't find another option in the system. And then second, they drive change for Boston Public Schools. We wouldn't be even having the battle to reform how we hire our teachers or lengthen our school day in BPS if the charters weren't there showing a better way.
A couple of questions, John, if I can. We're talking to John Connolly, city councilor, who is, as of the moment, the only candidate for mayor of the city of Boston. I want to talk politics for a minute. Historically, candidates who challenge the mayor can't raise a nickel from, for example, real estate interests because obviously they're nervous about the mayor getting reelected. Mayor won a huge margin, 70% amongst black voters. Where do you get your money and where do you pick up the 17,000 votes in the city assuming Menino runs, that make you the next mayor? Where did any of that happen?
I've built a pretty strong fundraising network that I think is independent of the reach of City Hall. And look, it's going to be long and hard. And when I go from here, I'm ultimately going to end up today in a small room without windows and a phone list to call people and ask them for money. So it will be hard, but I can raise that money. I've probably been the best fundraiser on the city council. And yeah, listen, you can't win this election if you don't get a strong vote from communities of color. I think my message around reforming schools resonates with all families. But also, look at what I've done with my life. I've gone into the classroom with the kids who are victimized by the achievement gap. Last year, I ran a campaign with my colleague Ayanna Pressley that broke all the rules in Boston politics. I have a deep commitment to every neighborhood in this city, and I think I'm going to do really well in every community.
You know, one last question for me, John Conley, a city councilor running for mayor against Tom Menino, assuming he does run. You know, the mayor, you love the mayor. Everybody loves the mayor. He's got a legendary temper, and he can be a little bit vengeful. I mean, are people going to have to sneak their contributions to you in brown paper bags under cloak of darkness?
No, definitely.
I mean, lots
not
of people
that.
Are afraid to come out of the closet and say, I'm supporting an opponent of Tom Menino. That's a big problem for you.
That's a big challenge for me. I've got to show people that I'm viable and I can win. But I'll tell you what excites me the most about my campaign, and I know every candidate says, oh, my campaign is going to be different. Here's where mine is going to be different. You're going to be able to see it right away. I am going to have moms and dads across this city knocking on doors asking people to vote for me, and no other campaign machine looks like that.
Have you seen Tom Menino since that you started floating that you might be running a couple of days ago?
Yeah, I bumped into him a couple of times.
How'd that go?
We just saw each other in passing. I called him this morning.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and I left.
Did you speak to him?
I had to leave him a message, and I'm sure we will connect. But I wanted to convey to him, you know, listen, I deeply respect you. I respect your commitment to the city, and I don't know if you're going to run or not, but if you do, I'm going to run a positive campaign focused on new ideas, and I hope we can have a real debate about our schools.
And let me be clear, assuming that it doesn't go as well as you hope it will go, John, we know you hope it does, you're not going to do like the guy in 2009 and move out of town afterwards, correct?
No. Listen, I am Boston to my core, and I'm going to raise Claire and Teddy, and we have number 3 on the way in this city.
Congratulations.
And, you know, part of what drives me here I got the best of Boston growing up, but I grew up in a time when a lot of kids didn't. And I want Claire and Teddy to grow up in a better city than I did. And that means whatever happens for me, I'm always going to work to contribute to the city. But I'm going to win. And I'm going to run to win, and I'm going to win.
John, we really appreciate it. A lot of luck, and we hope to see you a lot between now and November. John Connolly.
Thanks, Marjorie. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much for being with us, City Councilor John Connolly. Coming up, people go to casinos with the hopes of getting rich. Up next, a man who rescues casinos that are going broke and wants to open one here. That's next on Boston Public Radio.